Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
I'm Lisa Stone, and you're listening to Parenting Aces. Welcome to Season 13 of Parenting Aces Podcast, a proud member of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and this week is the launch of a series of podcasts we're going to be doing as part of our new relationship with the Coach Life coaching platform, and more about that as you hear the podcast and as you hear subsequent episodes. But before I get into this week's conversation with Coach Diego Moyano, which y'all are going to just be blown away, and I have to say I could have stayed on with him for 5 more hours and still not covered everything. So you are in for a real treat. But I want to just give you a quick rundown on Coach Life. It is a new online coaching platform that has video content from a variety of top coaches, from junior coaches, developmental coaches, college coaches, professional coaches. There's nutrition information, there's fitness information, there's footwork information, there's the mental side of the game. It is an amazing new resource available to anyone, and it is a subscription service. But the caveat is they are offering a very nice discount to the Parenting Aces community. So if you are interested in signing up with Coach Life, there's going to be a special link in the show notes, and I want you to be sure and check those out at parentingaces.com so that you do get the discount. And there is a special discount code that you'll need to use for this episode. That code is Diego, and that's capital D-I-E-G-O, and then capital P, capital A for Parenting Aces. So the code again is Diego PA. That is the discount code for this episode of Coach Life. And I hope that you will go visit their website. It is coachlife.com. And you're just going to be when you see everything that they have and all the amazing coaches available to help you as you navigate through this journey. Now, back to this episode with Diego Moyano. Many of you know that name because he was with USTA Player Development for 10 years and has worked with some of the top American players in the game. He also played professionally himself, and he has just an amazing wealth of knowledge that he shares with us in this episode. He's currently working with top American player Francis Tiafoe and doing some great work with Francis. And we get into a little bit the difference of coaching these players as juniors and then what it looks like once they turn pro and how he transitions and helps them transition to the pro tour. So on top of all of that, we get into his relationship with USTA, his work with USTA, what USTA player development is all about, where junior competition fits into all of that. So like I said, just gobs of information. Y'all are going to love it. He is just an amazing, amazing coach. And I feel so honored to get to interview him and now to get to share that with all of you. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Coach Diego Moyano.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Diego, it's so great to meet you. So great to get you on the podcast. I am thrilled to get some time from you away from Francis Tiafo, who I know is your main charge these days. And congratulations on all the great work that you guys have been doing together.
All right. Hi, Lisa. How are you? And thank you so much for having me. And thank you for your words. It's a tough journey. I mean, we are navigating a tough moment right now because it's points, you know how the ATP works. I mean, you have 12 months to kind of defend all the points, and we are having tough moment getting everything done and try to get moving, you know, and in terms of getting better, not only defending points and not only the ranking, but also getting better. So it's a tough journey, but it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Well, you've got a great charge. Francis is full of personality, and I've seen him on the practice courts, and I know he loves to work hard and play hard at the same time, and that's got to be a blast for you.
Yeah, totally. We have a really good relation. We worked together before when he was 15 to 19, and now, okay, we joined forces again, and it's a lot of fun, yeah.
I love it. Well, let's jump right in to a conversation about the junior tennis journey and the various pathways that are available to players who want to achieve a high level in the juniors, maybe go on to play in college, maybe even go on to play professionally. And I want to really touch on what the role of the coach is in those various pathways, as well as what the role of the parents is from your perspective as a coach, and then how you all work together to form a team to really help the player achieve their highest level.
Oh, that's a great topic. And my answer is going to be kind of an extended answer. And kind of, I have to touch couple things. One, I feel that it's important the coaching role in terms of we assuming that the majority of parents they don't play tennis, or if they play they play just recreational tennis. That's the majority. And as a coaches, we have to help the parents, the kids, everybody to navigate through the journey. It's not easy. So that's on the first place. So on the other side, we have to understand that the parents are going to be always part of the kids' journey and part of the team. So there's no such a thing about I coach the kid and the parents are outside. No, the parents are inside. The parents are very important. Are the support? Are the people that are going to take the kid to the tournaments? Are the people that they're going to support when the kid is losing? They kind of comfort the kid after the loss, or be happy for the kid when they're winning, or you know, understand. So the parent role is huge, is very important. And as a coach, we have to understand, because how many times we hear, oh no, I have the pressure from my parents. So this is where the coach jump in as well. It's not only teaching forehand, backhand, it's building character, it's understanding and building that bridge between, or have the kid understand that it's not such a pressure, try to help the parents how to navigate through the journey and sometimes not getting too excited when they're winning or losing, you know. So that's important. And then this journey, like you say, when everybody want to be professional, everybody want to be Novak Djokovic or Carlos Alcaraz, but it's tough. It's a tough journey when the kid deciding to go college, and when how we know if the kid is ready to turn pro. Is my son or my daughter good enough? Should I invest on the thing? What about school? Should my kids stay on the regular school, or should they drop and go to a kind of online school and having more training? those are like all the questions that we have in all the time. So if you allow me, I'm going to go through a little bit like a general idea, general pathway. On the first place, in my philosophy, I don't really like when the kid in general, drop school or they go too early on online school. I'm not saying that I don't like, but it's just a personal. Every kid is different, and as a main idea, I would like the kids to stay stay in a regular school as much as they can, if they have a good tennis situation and they can train. Number two, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, until 13 years old, as many other sports as possible. I don't like the specialization. I don't like that the kid is nine years old and he's just playing only tennis and he's working. So obviously, as many parents told me, yeah, my son, we try to get them on, or my daughter on different sport, but they come back to tennis. That's fine. But try not to go into the early specialization, meaning they can play football, they can play lacrosse, they can play basketball, they can play soccer, boys and girls, as much as they can. Then at 13, it becomes a little bit more specific, if you want. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between boys and girls in terms of their maturity. The boys, the ages for the boys are 14, 16, 18. And I'm going to explain a little bit why that age. With the girls, it's 2 to 3 years before that. So the girls are like 12, so 12 is the first, 14, 15, and then that the age of 18, it becomes a little earlier, 16 and a half. So with the boys, why 14, 16 a day? Normally, the boys at 14, they decide at that age which sport they like the most, what is the sport they're going to spend more time, more seriously. And then, they don't know pro, college, they don't understand that yet at 14. They like more one sport and they decide that they're going to do it more often and they're going to spend more time. At 16, the boys are already deciding kind of in which fashion they like to do that sport. Oh, I'm good enough. I think I would like to turn pro. I'm good enough. I think I can do like Division I college or Division II or just I'm not really focused on which division. I just want to go to the best college that I can. I mean, they have a specific like goal at that age, 16, 16 and a half. And then you get to the 18 years old, which you decide which pathway you can take. So it's a professional pathway, which is very unlikely. As a generation, 3% of that generation, 3 players out of 100, that's amazing, that's incredible. So we have this with the 97s and 98s. So Taylor Fritz turned pro, Tommy Paul turned pro, Riley Opelka turned pro, Francis Tiafoe turned pro. So before that, the other generation that we had that kind of number was Ryan Harrison, so the 92 basically. They didn't go to college. Ryan Harrison, Dennis Kula, a little bit, Jordan Cox, and Chateau. So that generation, that's what I'm saying. It's a 3% or even less. With the girls, at 12 years old, we have kind of an idea. The girls are more mature, more serious. That the boys at 12 years old, they like to do things correctly, and they like really focused, more focused at the boys at that age. At 14, we see how they start developing. And by 16, that's why we see a lot of girls going into the pro tour earlier, like 16, 17, 18, because they develop earlier and even before they need to the age of going college, they already turn pro because they're good enough or not. So the ages are like 2 to 3 years earlier than the boys. And then, well, we're going into the college pathway or professional pathway, that 3%, 2-3%. College pathway, which is a really, really important pathway here in the States. And well, some others, they just take a kind of a recreational pathway as well.
Right, right. I mean, there's so many choices, which makes it complicated if you're a parent, even if you're like me. I grew up playing tennis. I grew up in a tennis family. But when it was time for my kid to make these different choices, things had changed so much. I really didn't know what to do and, you know, was seeking guidance. So I think, you know, having coaches that really understand these pathway options is so crucial, and not just understand, but then take the time to actually sit down with the family and explain what these choices are.
Totally, totally. I totally agree. I think that's important, because one of the things that as a parent, I mean, we face is how I know when and which pathway and when. Because I don't want to be like sitting and like wasting time, but at the same time, I don't want to rush, and I want my kids to be happy and make the right choice, and that takes the time to kind of settle down, talk to the parents all the time, because it's not one talk; it's just navigate through the journey, which is every 3 months, 4 months, if something changed. The kids changing, growing, injuries, everything. So then you go, oh, the kid that I was beating, now I'm losing, and what happened? Before that kid, he was like small, and now he's six tall. So everything is changing, and you have to like help and trying to help them to make the right choices at the right time.
Yeah, for sure. And you're obviously very passionate about this. You're working with a new organization called Coach Life, where you're providing some videos and really trying to help players and the parents understand what it takes to kind of go through these pathways. Can you talk a little bit about why you decided to join Coach Life and what you're hoping to be able to accomplish with the work you're doing for that online subscription service?
Yeah. So in the first place, I love to give back a little bit everything, because at some point I was on that side. I was the 12, I was the 13, 14 years old kid that going through this pathway. So even if I was almost top 100, I never was a star. So I went through myself through the whole pathway about okay, so now I'm 14, 15, what I do, now I'm joining this. So when we talk about Coach Life, I love the idea of joining a kind of a service where we can give back to the parents, the coaches, the recreational players, we kind of the whole tennis community. Help to navigate on all these topics. So and on the same platform, you have me as with all my videos, and we talking about different topics about this where we just talk about the pathway. We're talking about the food world. We're talking about technique. We're talking about everything right there in one platform. But also you have nutritionists. You have a strength conditioning specialist. You have other coaches that developmental coaches. You have psychologists, a sport, you know, like footwork specialist. So you have everything in one platform, which I feel that is very beneficial for parents and coaches to kind of go into one side. I mean, just you open one platform and you have everything that you need to navigate. And we're launching also the technical kind of on the same platform, we helping the players to go through technical. So there's a lot of things. There is not just one tip because you that also exists already, you know, like few things that giving you tips here. No, we dig into the topics. So that's what I like the most, and I really, like I was telling you before, working with top players is something that passionates me, but also the other part of the coaching that I love the most is the developmental side of coaching. And I think Coach Life is giving me that opportunity to kind of give back and be close to the kids, the young players, recreational players, and the parents to also help on that.
I love that. And speaking of developmental, you worked with USTA for a decade, if I'm not mistaken, in player development. But before that, you grew up in Argentina. You grew up being coached in Argentina. And I'm really...
I'm going to interrupt because something that not many people know about me is I'm from Argentina. I grew up in Argentina until 14 years old. At 14, my parents got in bankrupt in Argentina where we faced a big economic crisis. Mm. And I have to... If I wanted to keep playing tennis, I needed to leave Argentina. That's what I did. I left Argentina and I went to France. So I did all my player career from France. I lived 16 years in France. And so from 14 to almost 29, almost 30, I live in France. And I made all my career from there. And then I went back to Argentina for a couple of years. Until I joined, I come to the States and I joined the USTA in 2009.
Oh, wow. I did not know about the French connection there. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I'm going to change my question because I was going to ask you the difference in your experience being coached in Argentina versus how you coach with American kids now in the States. But right. I guess we have to throw the French piece in there too.
No, that's a great question. That's a great question because when they ask me, it's something that I mentioned in Coach Life as well, a little bit my connection. So it's a great question, a great way to rephrase the question. But as a coach, I have this mix about the Latin, Spanish, Latin, like footwork school, very, very like footwork based and like really focused on the mobility and long points and how to move to every ball. Because you grew up on clay court, you need to find the ball every single time. The French school, which is very technical, so the French always their reputation. They were like super, super technical. They like consider that every stroke has to be perfect to give you the best chance to succeed in the future. So you see on every sport in France, they put so much time on that. So I am very technical as the French school. And then in the States, I kind of the mentality about the aggression, the focus on the serve, the return. Every shot counts. You see the sport. I always kind of it's not an analogy, but I try to explain the way that if you look at the Latin sport outside tennis is the soccer. Everything is continuous. So it's always full work. You play, you go in offense and defense, everything in once, and you keep going. When you come to state is you go to American football, you go to baseball, is one shot, one pitch, one throw. Is that count? Is offense? One team is in offense, one team is in defense. Mm-hmm. And then you address. So it's very, like, very offensive. When you are on offense, it's very offensive. Every shot counts. So here, that's why the focus is on the serve. So that in other countries, you don't see that. In Europe, right now, the few years ago, they dominate. Why they dominate? Because they have this ability to play 6 months indoor because they're winter and 6 months outdoor on clay court. So they play a lot on clay court. What we're trying to establish when I was on the program at the USTA a few years was that we wanted to play and move a lot of tournaments, young, especially the younger, to the clay court, trying to replicate that. So when you talk about Tommy Paul winning the French Open against Taylor Fritz in the final, it was not just a coincidence. It was just not lucky. It was a work that, we've been doing for years until to get to that to those results. So when you see players winning on clay, that's kind of that was the idea behind the development on the developmental side. So the clay helped a lot. So that's kind of me as a coach. The aggression from the American school, the technical from the French, and all the footwork from the Latin Spanish school.
That's amazing that you have all of those things that you can pull from to help your players develop a well-rounded, effective game. And I'm assuming because of the Latin influence that the fitness side is so crucial, because movement on clay, I've only played on the clay a few times, but when I have within 5 minutes, I'm gasping for air. I mean, it is, the movement is incredibly challenging.
Yeah, totally. So there's two things. One is the endurance. So I don't like when my players, they get tired. So that's it's something that we've been talking with Jim Courier back in the days. Is one of the things that he was number one. And when he talked with the kids, he said, look, it's something that you can control. Mm-hmm. You can control. You can say, look, I need to get better my endurance. Man. So that's one. And I think that we can control. And the other thing is the footwork. So it has to be, for me, is crucial. It's tennis is a movement sport. So you're moving all the time. You're not receiving. You're not hitting the ball twice on the same spot. So it's even a few inches, you have to move and find the ball every single time. So there's no reason why when you work and you do drills, and you should be in movement every single time. So that's another crucial part. So that's why I'm putting so much emphasis on the movement, finding the ball. That is open the window for the eyes and mind, because you're finding the ball, you need to recognize where the ball bounced, where you're going to meet the ball, how to cut the angle, understanding the court, understanding the angles, the different heights, where to meet the ball every single time. And then from there, you need the technique. And the first shot, and that's when the connection with the American school is the first shot, the serve and return is gonna open the door to play a little bit like easier shot, because already the tennis is so difficult that if you can have a first shot already with advantage, you can be more likely in control of the points.
Love that. I want to switch gears a little bit. And I mentioned that you're currently working with Francis Tiafoe. You told us that you also worked with him as a teenager. And I'm just curious, how is your coaching relationship different now than when it was when he was 15, 16? What are some of the ways that you've had to kind of change, or maybe you haven't had to, but if you have, how have you had to change how you communicate with him, the types of things that you're working with him on, and just the day-to-day training?
Oh, that's a great question. So, you know, I work with Francis, I work together with JTC, and when I was at the UCA, so we kind of had him together, and I worked 4 years with him, 4 years and a half with Taylor Fritz, 8 years with Tommy Paul, 7 years and a half with Riley Opelka, 5 years with Dennis Kulda. So why I'm saying that? Because back on the days, I always say when you're a coach and you have a player like that, is a young player, you almost manufacture that player. Without overcoaching, which is one of my main things as a philosophy, giving the kid the air to kind of try out and do their own thing, but you kind of manufacture that player. Now, that was Francis younger, you kind of help him, even if he has an unbelievable feeling for the game, and you trying to, like, you more into the game, and this ball goes there. Now when you take a man, you take a top 10 player already, you take somebody that is already good. I always say, when the kids are kids, you go from 100% the coach and 0% the kid to 90, 10, 80, 20, and as they go, they grew up, and they get better, that goes the other way, 50-50, 40-60. And so right now, with Francis, when we talk about tennis, it's not 80% the coach and 20% Francis as it was. Now it's almost the inverse. It's almost 80% the player and 20% the coach. This is something that when you work with the player, that something is very important to understand. One thing is the kid when they're like 11, 12, 13, 14, then 17, 18, and a kid, now I always say a kid, but a player that is a man already, 26 years old, already top 10, already been playing on the biggest stages. So now he knows probably more than any coach that he can coach. Doesn't mean that he's not important. Like I always say, the coach job is very important, but it's a 10%. The 90% is the player. We are very important, but it's the 10%. When they are young, it's very important that the coach has a bigger role and much more impact.
Interesting. So now, as the coach, you're letting him kind of drive the bus a little bit more and tell you maybe, oh, I need, you know, I felt like my toss was off. Can we work on my serve, you know, today?
100%. 100%. I was working on a presentation a couple of days ago, and that's one of the things. It's like you have two parallel lines. As a coach, you have two parallel lines. One is the long-term developmental pathway. Yeah? You have your developmental plan. You have the areas of focus that you're going to focus every 3 months. And the other parallel line is the weekly kind of progression. So when they're kids, the focus is on the developmental line. You spend more time on the practices about the developmental. You always working toward the future. And you listen a little bit about the kid telling you, oh, I don't feel the backhand, because you know that they know that every day there's something that is gonna. When you work with somebody like Francis, the two parallel lines exist, but it's the other way around. Mm-hmm. So you listen to the daily kind of feeling or the weekly feeling about, hey, I need to do this. I feel that I'm slow, or I need to be more explosive, or my backhand on the line is not working very well. Myself, I need to, you know, like, it's more about what is happening, and you're still working, you're still putting some time on the long-term developmental pathway. But, you know, it's the most important when they draw is about more result-oriented, more like they know what they need in a short term, because right now when you have, for example, you finish, let's say, Australian Open, and you know that in 3 weeks, you're going to play a couple tournaments, and 4 weeks from now, you have Indian Wells and Miami. You don't have too much time about the long-term developmental pathway. So you, like, really focus on, and you listen to them, and you really put the work on that.
I love that. I want to, again, switch gears a little bit and go back to the junior development and talk a little bit about ratings, rankings, wins, and losses, and where those things fit into a long-term developmental plan.
All right, that's another great question. So until 12 years old, 12 and a half, for me, there's no, even if the ranking exists and is good, the only help that you have there, even from 13, 14, is that the kid, the Monday, if they win Monday, we're going to have a big smile, and it's going to be easier to push, right? All right, let's work 2 hours side to side, and he's going to do it with a smile, or she's going to do it with a smile. If they lost first round, then we're going to have to, like, spend more time on talking and working and kind of trying to get them feel good and try to kind of convince them that everything is fine, and same with the parents. you know, like if everything goes well. But at the same time, you don't want the kids to win too much. I always say when the parents, they look at me like, what are you talking about? Because when the kid is winning too much, is tough, is not as coachable as it can be. It makes sense. When the kid is winning too much, you go and say, well, we need to work on the forehand and say, coach, I just not missing forehand. I say, well, but that forehand or that backhand, or we need to work on the serve. I say, coach, I just kick it in and nobody, you know, I don't have a problem with the serve. As a coach, you're looking at 7 years from now and say, well, that serve has to be better because you're going to be, for example, I'm talking with I look at the parents and I say, well, you're going to be 6'3", 6'4". Your serve is going to be really important. And they look at me like, how you know? Well, I have some experience or the footwork. Well, you're probably going to be 5'11 or 6 feet. You're going to have to move a little bit more. You're not going to, you know, like, and so that's important. The kid need to win, but no winning too much. Mm-hmm. So that's the one. At the 13, 14, 15, you like building a little bit more the game, the patterns, and so now it's important that you go in a little bit more into match play and the patterns and understanding the court a little bit more, understanding the game a little bit more, 14, 15, 16, 17. And then, yes, it's true that 15, 16, 17, 18, the kids are more mature. They understand a little bit more the court, the game, and they want to win more, and then the pressure. But they already, at 16, 17, 18, they're already more mature to take the winning and losing and where they want to go with their game and how. So then it's fine. You help them to navigate through that.
Okay.
So that's a little bit roughly a little bit how we do a little bit how I think about the ages of the game.
So what I did not hear you say is that by age 15, they should have a UTR of this or be ranked here. I didn't hear you talk about that.
No, because I'm not a big believer of ranking. Everything when on those ages, what the parents should know or everybody should know is that the kids, they change in every 6 months. They go through a big change. So it doesn't really matter at that time. Again, it is important. Well, why is it a little bit important? Because, well, it's true that if you're going to play a national, for example, if you want to play Easter Bowl or if you want to play Clay Court Nationals or Kalamazoo, or well, you need to be, let's say, top 150 in the country. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So you know that with 150 in the country, you make those tournaments. So that, for that reason, some other tournaments that they... If you want to play, for example, if you 16, 17, if you maybe, I don't know, 80 in the world IGF, you make the Grand Slam. You know, like those kind of things, yes, because there's a cutoff, there's a deadline, so you need to have certain ranking. Now, the kids, you have the late bloomers, you have the early, you know, the early kids that they mature like immediately and so there's so many variables that you working through on those 8, 9, 10 years, 11 years. Well, imagine the kid is sometimes I sit down with the parents and the kid is 10, 11 years old. I say, well, whatever you do, don't worry, he's not gonna make top 100 until 21 at least. So you have 12 years. So you're gonna stress that much for 12 years. Let me stress out. I'm the coach. Let me stress out about that journey, and then we'll go through that. You know, like until 16, 17, I'm not really that happened naturally. Mm-hmm. I'm not forcing. I wouldn't make changes on this or the different decision based on UTR this and that. No, we have to chase points. I wouldn't. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to play better tennis. I'm focused on the level. I think the most important thing is always get to the level. When the kid is playing good tennis, is know, understand the court, understanding their game, they're going to play better tennis, and that's what the focus should be.
Yeah.
That's not really focused. And then, again, yeah. 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, college, yes, the system is taking you through that journey about college. Yes, you're going to change a match, you're going to play this, you're going to play number one, number three. But you're already old enough to take that.
Right. Right. And I mean, you are saying the same thing that I try to say, which is if you put the work in and focus every day on trying to get a little bit better, the rating and the ranking are going to take care of themselves, right? If 100%. You're working hard. Yeah.
100%. I mean, that happened naturally. It's working hard, putting the mind there, and then let things happen. Right. Let the things happen. Doesn't matter if you want to really want to be UTR 13 right now. If you're not ready, it's not going to happen. It's just it's not going to happen. So yeah. Now focus on what you can really, what really matters, which is 11, and what you can control. So you cannot control the outcome of the matches. You cannot. But you can control how you go over the matches, how much you learn about the those losers or the winning, and then go back, talk to your coaches, and put the work again, and keep getting better and keep getting better. That's the thing that you can control. So that's what is important for me, in my opinion.
I love that. Question for you: what should the kind of equation be at different stages of junior development between private lessons, group drills, match play, and tournament play? And how do you figure out how to kind of work that equation?
Great job, Lisa. I mean, that's an amazing question. No, I really, really are, because this is something that talking with the parents, I think that all those are really important things. One is where that fits. The private lesson. The private lesson is the information. The information when they're young, the kid, they need that information. Doesn't mean that they're gonna process the information at the right time, at the real time. You give the kid information. And I always tell the parents and even the kids, you explain, you say, don't expect to process the information right away. So you have the information, and we're going to repeat that over and over, but you can process at your own time. That's one. So it's important. Yes, it's very important. All the time, only private lesson, no, because on the other side, the kids, they need to play on their own. They need to try those how we process information. Yeah, by thinking, by watching different matches, but by trying. Yeah. You have to explore, you have to try what the coach told you to do, and means and mind. And you don't need your parents, you don't need your coach, you don't need that. So you need your peers, you need the other kids to try and play and have fun. Right? So that's the other thing. So the group kind of lesson or the group playing. And then you have the match play, which can be the tournament. You have two ways to talk about the match play. One are the tournaments, and the other one is the in-house match play, which I like to divide it like that. The in-house, okay. when I bring another kid and they play with my kids, and the coach are allowed to kind of jump in and stop a point, and sometimes we are a little bit annoying, like I told the kids, oh, coach was annoying today, you know, like. Or I explain to the kid, well, today I'm gonna stop the points, I'm gonna stop the matches, and we're gonna talk a little bit more. So in house, and so those are more important. Sometimes you're not saying too much. Sometimes you explain more things, and then you let them play the tournaments, and more likely if you can, you can film and then watch the matches. You know, like there's a process of not necessarily winning, but learning. And so those, how and how much, I feel that when they're like I would say 9, 10, 11 years old, 12 years old. I would say until 11, roughly 3 private lessons per week, I would say. That's a good number. 2 to 3, like no, I wouldn't say no more than that. That's enough. Then another 2 match play in house, and then the rest group lesson could be group lesson or just playing with kids, free play. Mm-hmm. When they play each other with the kids and they're alone, no parents and no coaches, they can play. They say, how much should they play? Well, if they are alone with the kids, same age, as much as they want. If they want to play 8 hours, 8 hours. But there's a huge difference. If they are with coach, the lesson shouldn't be going more than an hour and a half. The kids, they don't have the focus, they don't have the strength to take the ball, they don't have the, you know, like, so if it's a group lesson, another, like, they can take maybe with another kid and the coach talking, they could take 2 hours, but no more. And then until 13, 14, you're going to play around 40 matches per year and tournaments, like around there, if the kids want, all the time is asking the kid. From 13, 14 to 16, 17, you're gonna ramp up to around 60 matches, because they're gonna learn, they're gonna have more idea about their game, their patterns, and then from there you're gonna try to go into around between 60 and 80 matches per year. Wow. That's a little bit the balance.
Wow,
Lisa, yeah. I'm just run. Can I have 1 second to put the light on? I mean, I see that.
Yes.
I'm not.
I'm going to pause. Okay, now we can see you better. That's good.
Perfect. Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. So I would be remiss if I didn't talk about your time with USTA Player Development. And I know our audience is very interested in the role of USTA in junior tennis in this country, and also the role of specifically player development at USTA in junior tennis in this country and how it's changed. You were there 10 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And
10 years as the lead national coach. Yes.
Yeah. And so can you tell us what was your job description? What did they tell you were expected to accomplish in that role?
So basically, my role when I joined the UCA was develop top 20 players, the next generation of champions. That's the way, and that's why I joined the UCA. And now from here, I can talk. That was my role, and we have a great team. And from there, I'm going to give you my opinion about it's just an opinion, because obviously that's open to the public, and everybody can have different opinion. I was inside the player development, and I was outside before, and I'm outside now on the private sector. So the role of the UCA, they have several roles. The number one is working with the private sector. It's not just USTA going into the developmental part of tennis and not without the private sector. It's together. So what happened is you have an academy and you are a coach, you are a private coach, and obviously you have to live and you have to make money and you have to you need I don't know, you are the whole day on court and working with different kids, and suddenly you have the chosen one right there in your academy. You don't have the time because you have to make money, and obviously the parents cannot pay you that much. So now what happened there? It's either you waste that talent because you cannot take care of that talent, or that talent is going to the USTA player development, and that you get that help and you start working with the player development. That's what we did a lot at the USTA. We were working with parents, with coaches, and giving the kids opportunities. That's number one. So now it wasn't like USTA or private sector, is together. That was something that was important, and giving them opportunities.
Can I just ask for some clarification there? When you say giving them opportunities, that was coaching, that was taking them to tournaments, was that funding as well?
Everything, yes. Because it's a very important topic to understand where the opportunities come. Because you say, somebody can say, yeah, but you bring it to Europe, the top three. Where are the opportunities for the rest? No, that's the opportunity. You go in, so one of the other part of the USTA, so the player development need to work with the 1% of the 1%. That's the player development, right? So when you get to the center, the player development main center, you working with the best kids in the country. And as we know, United States is one of the powerful countries in terms of tennis. So you they're so big. So one, you need to detect the kids in early ages. Otherwise, the kids, they have so many sports that they go, you lose a lot of talent. So now, number one of the USTA, the talent ID. We went on that time, we went from almost none to 17 regional centers, and then we went to 21. Then we realized that 21, they were too much, and we come back to around 17, 18. So we cut the country. Why we cut the country like that? Just to recognize as many young kids as we could. So no wasting any talent. So we went, we invite. So now where the opportunities come? If you look from outside, you say, well, you give opportunities to the top five in the country. No. Come level three, level two, level one. So you recognize the best kid with the coaches in every region. Those kids, they have the opportunities to go through those camps. You go to level one camp, you get invited to a level two, you get invited to a level three, and then you get invited to the USTA, right? Mm-hmm. It was in Boca Raton when I was here for 7 years, and then we moved to Orlando for another 3 years until I left the UCA. But that's where the opportunity comes. So you have the coaches and the team helping every kid along the pathway, talking with the parents, telling them, founding, going with camps. So you become like a reference. The UCA becomes a reference in terms of worldwide, in terms of the level that every kid needs to play. That's another big role that nobody talk. So when you're at the USTA, you have to, like, not only bring in the kid outside the country and like to Europe and competing against the best, but you already know which ones are, I mean, we competing against. So for example, I give you an example more specific. So I was with Tommy Paul, with Riley Opelka, with Francis Tiafoe, with Taylor Fritz, right? So I knew that the reference was Zverev, Rublev, already those kids. So we were like having that we were competing with them. So those kids, we needed to keep working because Zverev, it was already like sometimes ahead, and Rublev as well. And you have like kids like that. Same with the 92s, and same, so you already, as a USTA, you like, because you are doing this, you are helping the coaches and the players and the parents to understand where is the reference. It could be many times you have the number one in the United States, but it wouldn't be number one in the world, or it's not at the level of the best player in the world, with the Europeans. So that's kind of another role. The standards, put the standards high for the kids and the parents and the coaches to meet those standards. I don't know if it makes sense. But
no, it does.
Another,
and, so,
you know, like,
And you're also looking at how those reference kids, I mean, the kids are the reference point, right? You're looking at what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, how they're training, what their coaches are teaching them, which tournaments are they playing, how many days a week, how many hours, where's the fitness, where's the nutrition, where's the mental side? All of that comes into it.
100%, 100%. And here is the role, the important role of the UCA. Because somebody can come to me and say, yeah, but the private sector can do it as well. Yeah. Totally. I totally agree. But how many academies they have that ability to have if you have three kids, have a coach for every kid, you know, it could be a boy, a girl, and the nutritionist and the strength conditioning and everything founded. Like the parents, they don't have to pay that much. If you find that in a private sector, you're going to have to pay it. Right. If you don't have the money, then you don't. That kid, that talent is going to be lost. Mm. The UCA, if you have a big talent, you have the ability to work through together to have that talent to grow on that. So those things are really important, because if you don't have that ability with the player development, so here there's two things. When we're talking about the USDA, we're talking about different departments. Right. The USDA has different departments. So right now we're talking about the player development. This is, for me, in my opinion, is working with the 1% of the 1%, the top elite, the best player. And you're going into, so the USDA, my job, and we can dig in onto that, I was having opportunities for everybody, but I was building different filters until we get the best of the best. And those players, so everybody had the opportunity. Mm. But well, tennis is not for everybody, because otherwise not everybody can be Roger Federer or Rafa Nadal or Carlos Alcaraz. There's one Roger Federer, one Rafa Nadal, and so on. This is how tennis works, yeah, at the high level. So you need to help everybody to have the opportunities, because you don't know who is going to be there. So everybody has the opportunity at the bottom. So you need to build a big or a large like group, but then building filters where only the best of the best get there and have the chance to compete against the best in the world. That's how it is.
Can I back up one second? So you mentioned the camps and that there are the three different levels of camps. So that entry-level camp had the widest filter, and you would take as many kids as you could into that level, see how they performed, and then the ones that rose to the top at that level would get invited to the next level, and so on.
So everything happened before that.
Okay.
So everything happened contacting. So I mentioned about cutting the country in, mm-hmm, in 21 regions or 17, depending. It was tough to get the number to cover the whole country. Mm-hmm. But until we get around 17 was the right number, right? So then you contact with 17, every federation of every region start contacting with the coaches, start contacting the regional coaches. So we had in every region a lot of regional coaches who were in the tournaments in every region. So now we contacting, and there was a pathway of we have coaches for the 12 years old, the 10 years old. So at the USDA, at the player development, at the main center, those coaches, they were in charge of contacting those coaches, the regional coaches, to ask them which kids you think they need to be invited at the entry level camp. Mm. So then those regional coaches plus one or two of the USDA coaches, the national coaches, they were there for the camps. Uh-huh. When we see those, then the second group, the second level of camps, they were more decided about the regional coaches and the USDA coaches already knowing the kids, but invited to the second level. And the same process happened with that level to the next level. So you already have in the region those three levels. Then after that, the best, they were invited to the USDA. For example, I can give you a story, very, very, like really funny story. I had my 16 players invited to I was doing a playoff and 2 months of training at the USDA, and I had Tommy Paul, so I have that generation, right? Stefan Kozlov, I have Francis Tiafoe, Michael Moore, so I have a lot of invited, and I have my 16 players. So I'm at the moment, so I'm talking with you know, like I'm finishing organizing that, and the number 16, just I received an email that couldn't come. He had some things to do with at the school, so he couldn't come. So I have only 15. At that time, Ken Kinnear comes to me, and I was sitting in the office, and comes to me, you know, I have a kid that is a 13, pretty good kid. I saw the mom is a former top 10, the dad is another former tennis player. It's pretty good. I think he, so the name is Taylor Fritz. Okay, so I said, great. So that will be great. So right there, based on all the information that I had, I write an email and invite Taylor Fritz to this camp. And well, you know the story. I don't need to tell the story after that. So that's kind of how the connection about all how is working or was working. So that was the role about the USTA. And I think that's the role of the player development. Now, community tennis is a different role, which is important role, which is growing the tennis. That's a different role. My job, that's what I'm saying. It wasn't at the USTA. I was USTA player development, which is what was working with the top players.
Well, and let's understand that community tennis, that umbrella, is where junior competition falls under. Junior competition isn't under the player development umbrella. It is under the community tennis umbrella.
At that time, we have junior competition and pro tennis kind of on the at that time, we had those departments working together with us, with the player development.
But now it's under community tennis. Right? Oh, I lost you, Diego. I lost you. Hang on, I'm going to pause the recording. So we had a little technical glitch there for a second, but Diego is back. And Diego, we were talking about the difference between USTA player development and USTA community tennis, which the junior competition kind of structure falls under, correct?
Well, at the time that I was at the USTA, the player development, we were working very closely with the junior competition and with the pro tournaments. Mm-hmm. So kind of helping those departments to kind of be like interacting together with the player development, because I not only at some point we have some sort of interaction, even if the junior competition is abroad and in like a wider base, we have things to say with the top level competition. But again, right, is I feel that right now junior competition falls into right now it's a little bit like things change, I kind of, again, this is an opinion, and on that opinion, I feel that it has to be, the player development has a big role on American tennis. We can talk or the people can figure out the best way to allocate their resources or how, but I feel that has a big role on helping the community, the top players, the parents, the private sector working together, helping about calendar with the junior competition, with the top level of junior competition, trying to navigate again with the camps and the local like regional tournaments as well, important. So creating that filter, those parameters, putting the standards where it should be. So all those things not replacing the private sector, but for sure, without the plan of development, is going to be way tougher for the private sector and parents to navigate through that journey of like creating the next wave of American players.
Well, it's interesting because Coach Jose Higueras, who is no longer with USTA, but who worked in player development for many years, recently sent out an open letter, and I've read it, and you've read it, and lots of people have commented on it. But one of the things that he said in that letter that I thought was so interesting was that we have to understand the filter down effect that having top level American players at the professional level. And when I say top level, I mean people that are in the top 10, right? That are maybe winning slams, that are winning Masters 1000 and, you know, these high level mm-hmm. events, that there's a trickle down effect of that into grassroots tennis and driving interest in our sport so that we do get that next generation of player interested in learning how to play the game and interested in competing and interested in achieving high levels in the sport.
I mean, 100%. The way that I see a little bit, I always say when I joined the USTA, my obsession was building a ladder. You need, in my opinion, that ladder was broken in American tennis. So you have some players already like about to retiring, like Andy Roddick, James Blake, and that generation. I mean, long time. And when I'm talking about generation, I'm talking about 4, 5, 6, 8 players, not just one that is generation. But then you need to have the juniors already when that generation is on top. For example, right now when this generation is already on top, you need to have the 20 years old kid going into transition already beating the top guys. And then you need already to have 17, 18 kids, American boys and girls, winning Grand Slams. And then from there, you need the 16 years old kid, already a generation, competing against the European and the South American and the Asian kid already on top and taking them to those next level and next tournament. And then from there, you need the 13, 14 going to Le Petit Sas in France, competing against the top guys. And then you have the 11, 12 years old, against giving them opportunities and not only that, not only bringing the to the tournament, but also competing against the top level kids here. Right. So back on the days when Ryan Opelka, Tommy Paul, Francis Tiafoe, all those kids they were 13, 14, Zverev was coming to the center and practicing with them and Rublev and those kids. So we knew, and they were competing each other. And Hong was coming here, and Chang was coming here from the Korean kids. So we have that synergy of having that. So it's not what you see on the top is helped tremendously to build that ladder. But it, again, that is very important if you have the talent ID as well. Because if you're not recognizing and you're not helping the kids that are 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, is again, the ladder is broken. That pathway is broken. So you need that. You need the 17. That always say is very important. The people, they just look at one part, and the part normally is what they are on. No, you have the top players, which is very enjoyable, and you have the US Open, and it's fun. But that's the moment to work on the talent ID, recognizing the 8 and 9 and 10 years old that are the best in the country. And that's the moment to work closely with the junior tennis and the pro tour to help to navigate and having more tournaments. For example, we've been having tournaments, pro tour. That was a huge moment. January, February, we had the kids after Orange Bowl staying at the camp with me and training and having coaches coming in with the players and staying with me is January, February to go through. And we had all tournaments around 20 miles, futures, 15, 10 and 15,000 around the center. So that was helping tremendously. I was driving everybody to the tournaments and back, the coaches that were coming, the parents that were here, and everybody was a big synergy. So 4 months of training on clay. So again, when you see Tommy Paul, Taylor Fritz, Riley Opelka winning Wimbledon, the other guys winning French Open, Francis Tiafoe, Michael Moe doing, it wasn't just luck. I mean, it was the work behind that was like day by day, but from the private sector, from the UCA, from the parents, from the whole community to build up that. When without the player development, you put everything, the whole pressure on the private sector. And that is very, when I say private sector, I'm not only talking about just one academy or two academies. The private sector are the parents that have to work the whole day to get the money to pay the coaches to leave the academy to go to a tournament and take the kid. You know, the whole thing is very tough. You leave that part like just to that. That's what I think. And I'm not here, not only in States. In France, same thing. And so in France was always, I grew up in France. So my vision was France, obviously smaller country. So France is like way smaller than the States, so way easier. But again, they have everything cutting in pieces, and they have a regional center everywhere. So nobody could escape from kind of that detection. And so, when you go to the story of at that moment when I was living there, it was Sébastien Rochon, Arnaud Clément, Gilles Simon, Songa, Monfils. It wasn't lucky. It just was a work. Before, but that work, it takes 10 to 15 years to be built. So it's right. So easy to go down to the trash, and it's so difficult to rebuild that pathway for everybody. That is, then again, it is perfect. No, it's very tough to say, to like talking about something that is perfect, but definitely it's around there. And then you can put some more here, some more there, relocate the resources a little bit different way. But that's my opinion.
And the money has to be allocated toward that. And right now, USTA has made some pretty massive budget cuts. And so I think that was the impetus behind Jose's letter and, you know, hoping that the budget gets allocated in a manner that will help grow American tennis as opposed to cutting off that ladder, you know, where you need that connection.
Correct. This is always very dynamic. Like you say, it has to be relocated different ways and can be dynamic. Definitely the cat is off. I mean, Jose is my mentor and he was my boss he was the director of coaching. So it can be relocated. We can have discussion about, and you can have an idea, and I could have a different idea, but on the same kind of on the same model where you can relocate the money depending, because it's very dynamic. Sometimes you're gonna need more money on the talent ID, and sometimes you're gonna need more money. When imagine on this process that I'm talking about 10 years, we've been through the 17 sessions, 21 sessions, 17 sessions, 15 sessions. So regions, and that's we needed the money for that. But then when you start having 16, 17, 18 years old, Riley Opelka, Tommy Paul, Taylor Fritz, Francis Tiafoe, Michael Moe. So now you need, so I'm talking about the boys, but I can talk about Madison Keys, Lauren Davis, Sloan Stevens, Christina McKay. So I can go on the girl side. So when you have that group under the group, so now the money, it has to be kind of maybe relocated to that, because those kids, they're going to compete against the best kid of the other countries. So now you need the coaches, and sometimes it's going to be many times I was with them, but for example, with Taylor Fritz, his dad was with him, and the mom was there, and with Riley, same thing. And sometimes the private coaches, they were helping us to take the kids to different tournaments. So it was a kind of all together working toward that objective of building the next wave of big American players. So I feel that's the key. The key is not cutting off, it's just relocated the best way possible, understanding that it's very dynamic. And sometimes other parties, we needed more tournaments. So at some point, we relocate that into the tournaments, mm-hmm. the pro circuit, because we understood that Europeans, for example, what happened with Italy? So you can ask me what happened with Italy, why Italy has, they're just lucky,
they're booming. No,
what they did is they relocated money into tournaments. So now the whole year, you can play literally almost every week of the year, you can play Challenger and Future in Italy. Mm. So now that helped to grow the academies. So now the academies are all over Italy. So you have academies in Italy, academies in Spain, academies in Switzerland, academies everywhere there with former players, like working on the academies and helping them. So you have incredible amount of coaches with a great level because they're playing tournaments there. So everything helped. So it's lucky. No, it's not. It's just the work that are behind. Now, those tournaments can be maybe like continuously growing like that. No, maybe in a few years, they're going to need to relocate that money into the talent ID and keep it on. Like, that's where it's not. And we go in country by country, successful countries and successful generations, and you will see that situation over and over. Same with Australia, you count, and we talk about different, again, not the same, but around there, because it's very dynamic.
So, I mean, the bottom line is the money has to be available. How it's allocated is fluid based on how many players you have coming up, what the tournament landscape looks like in your country, what the coaching landscape looks like in your country, but the pool of money has to be there. And then the professionals, which was you when you were at USTA, it's Jose, it's the other national coaches, get together and understand that, oh, we need to shift some of the funding over here to the tournaments, or no, we need to shift some of the funding over here to travel for these players, or whatever it is. But that pool of money still has to be in existence to keep funneling through the pipeline and producing top players.
100%. That's my opinion. 100%. Yeah. The money has to be there with really clear rules or guidelines. Mm-hmm. To have everybody that opportunity, but again, the discussion could be is how we relocate that money, what is the best way, and understanding also that is dynamic.
Yeah.
3 years from now, that money shouldn't go that way. It should, like you said, you described it very well, depending the coaching situation, the tournament situation, the key to the wave of the tournament, the talent ID, whatever it requires for the country at that moment.
Yeah.
But that's what the discussion and the whole community, which is important, when you build the trust of that, the whole community is integrated on those discussions. But it shouldn't be a part of funding, I mean, in any way, because you're losing the ability. It takes so long to build that ladder. I'm calling that ladder of 10 generation, I mean, the 12, the 14, the 16, that ladder, and it's so easy to destroy that when you destroy, it takes another 10 to 15 years to rebuild that.
Yeah.
And again, I'm talking with the boys, but I'm talking with the girls as well. So when I joined the USTA, I was lead national coach with the men's and men's and women's. Mm-hmm. Why I took the side of the men's tennis is because the women's side, it was already that letter that I'm talking, it was like already built. That pathway, it was like 12, it was Amanda Nimisova, Sonia Kennan, they were like 13, 14 already playing well, but you had like Madison Keys, and you had Christina McKay, and you had the 92s, and you had the 94s. And so everybody, you saw that behind Serena Williams and Venus, they were all coming. That was the question of okay, when? But everything is about to happen. On the men's side, it was we started this conversation with it was my obsession because I started, okay, the college tennis, same thing. When you have, for example, when I joined it, my first, the other day we were talking with Stevie Johnson, and we're like, same thing, get together all the college players. So we had a camp in Boca Raton. We have Ryan Williams, Tenny Sandgren, Bradley Klein, Stevie Johnson. Stevie Johnson was like throwing up on my core on the first coming back from California. It was like 100 degrees in June, and he was like throwing. So we were like when he retired, he said, "Well, from that day to this day that now retiring, it was a long journey," and we started like laughing about that. But again, it was like so many great players that they make top 100, top 50, whatever. That is same thing. You put in the junior, you put in the college player. The college player, same thing. When they leave that great journey, and it's super important going through the 3 years, 4 years of college tennis. They have a blast. They improving so much. And then what happened when they need to go to who is going to help them? Yeah, the private sector can help somehow. The college, they're going to try to help them. They have a base. But where is the money to go, the coaching, to travel? Because the college coach cannot travel, obviously. Yeah. So who are taking them to go to the tournaments and navigate through the challenge of the futures and so on and so on for 18 months? Normally, it takes for a good for NCAA player, champion, for NCAA champion or finalist, a good college player to make a top 100, it takes around 18 months in average, let's say. Who is going to help them to navigate those 18 months? About when you start like putting all the costs together, it makes, I don't know, around $200,000 to $250,000 per year per player. So who is going to help them? Right. So that's when you start like putting every piece together of the talent ID, who is going to help the parents, the 12, the 14, the 16, the junior, the college. When you start putting together, you understand that you need the money. You need the money. And that's where the federation, for a country like this, a powerful country with super big, that's where you need the federation. If it's small, we can talk. It's easier to kind of get together. Here, you need to get together somebody from Seattle, somebody from California, somebody from Alabama, somebody from New York, and get together as much as you can. How you do that? You're going to tell the parents to say, hey, you need to go to Florida, you need to go to LA every month, twice a month. But again, understanding that you work with the 1% of the 1%. So that's the role of the player development.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I really appreciate you digging into that. We've got to wind this up, as much as I hate to. I'm enjoying speaking with you so much. But before we wind up, I want to just give you an opportunity to tell our audience how they can find you. I know you've got a new website. So do you want to share that with us?
So again, I'm all those topics we're gonna have it. I mean, through Coach Life, that's where you're gonna find not only me talking, but and a lot of topics like this one. And you're gonna reach me. You can reach me obviously in person, but I think that platform is gonna help tremendously the parents and the kids and the recreational players and navigate through this beautiful journey. So that's huge. It's gonna be like launch like at the end of this month or around the weekend of April 21st. So hopefully that inspire a lot of kids and help parents and coaches to navigate.
Love it. And we'll have all those links in the show notes on parentingaces.com. So make sure to check that out. We're going to make it super easy for you to find Diego and the other coaches on Coach Life and to get in touch with him. Diego, it has been an absolute pleasure. I have enjoyed this so, so much. Thank you. And I hope we'll get a chance to do this again.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lisa. And I'm so sorry for all the technical issues. I'm not like technologically, I'm not the best, but thank you so much. I really love talking about tennis and help everybody as much as I can. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And to my audience, thank you so much for tuning in. We will catch you next time on Parenting Aces.
I'm Lisa Stone, and you've been listening to the Parenting Aces podcast for tennis parents by a tennis parent. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to us and write a review on iTunes. For more information on navigating the junior and college tennis journey, please visit us online at parentingaces.com. Thanks for tuning in and sharing us with your tennis community.